Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
We all have a perception of what Elizabeth I looked like. The auburn hair, very pale skin, a high forehead, painted lips and lightly flushed cheeks. It's an image that has resonated throughout the centuries with the iconography of the Virgin Queen. Portraits in her lifetime, even those of the older queen, would seem to suggest that makeup was used to lightly accentuate lips and cheeks alongside a sheer wash of white base on her skin, while film and television portrayals tend to favour the use of heavy rouge and thick white paste makeup, which only grows heavier as the queen ages. But what do we know of her actual appearance? And how was that appearance altered through the use of cosmetics? What products were typically used and how were they made? Today, I'm joined by Sally Poynter, educator and author of The Artifice of Beauty, a history and practical guide to perfumes and cosmetics, to decipher the truth about Elizabeth's image and how her use of makeup has become part of her enduring legacy. Sally Poynter, welcome to Not Just the Tudors.
Oh, well, I'm very happy to be here. Lovely to talk to you.
It's lovely to talk to you too. We worked together, I think it might be as long as 15 years ago, on a series called The Secret Life Of, and had a lot of fun talking about different people in the past.
We did. We got into a lot of different potions and made quite a bit of mess, if I remember correctly.
So I am delighted to have the opportunity to talk to you again about makeup in the past and also to find out what new things you've discovered over the last few years. I guess people might not have a sense of how one goes about practically researching historic makeup. Maybe we should start there. Are there surviving recipes or documented techniques that you can draw on?
A lot depends on the time period you're looking at. The further back you go, the more you have to look obliquely. So, for example, if we were looking at Roman cosmetics, whilst there are a few cosmetic recipes written down amazingly, we also learn more by looking at what people say about attitudes to cosmetics. So if people are getting outraged about the amount of makeup the young are wearing, you know that it's quite widespread. If nobody's mentioning it, perhaps it's not quite so active. By the time we get into the early modern period, though, say the time of the Tudors, the spread of things like the printing press has mean that household books, household texts are becoming extremely widespread. And the vast majority of these, as well as including recipes for the very best jam or how to turn the perfect pastry, they will include cosmetic recipes in a remarkable range of styles.
So do you think we can read into that many women are wearing makeup in the 16th century?
It is always a little bit tricky to say everybody because class structure is far more strongly divided in the past than it is today. What we do know is that everybody from the middle classes could, if they wish to. And in fact, we do have evidence that fairly humble women are. There's a lovely quote by a chap called Henry Peacham, who says that for a penny, a chambermaid may buy as much red ochre as serves 7 years for the painting of her cheeks. That's a chambermaid. If she wants to wear blusher, she only needs to spend a penny and she's got a very basic cosmetic that will last her a very, very long time. What we think is happening, though, is that a lot of these recipes are intended for women just to understand how things work. And in some cases, women are actually making extra money by selling cosmetics to women in a social strata above them.
So do we have a sense of attitudes towards makeup at the time? I mean, are they socially approved? I wonder there about that social dynamic of the classes. Is it something that actually if you're upper class or, you know, of the higher ranks of society, it's acceptable, but not so much if you're a serving maid, for example?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The general attitude seems to be you would prefer people not to know that you're using any sort of cosmetics. Many of the hints are phrased in a way that they're almost medicinal, that this will clarify your skin, this will brighten your hair, this will give you clear eyes, this will give you your fresh breath. They're not saying, here is the latest colour, plaster yourself in it. It's very much about enhancing what nature gave you. And often the attitude is that, well, you shouldn't really do it, but if it means that your husband likes you better for it, then this is a good thing all round.
So what was the beauty ideal of the time? What were they seeking to achieve?
There's very much a trend for pale skin, a high brow, a slightly oval face, gently flushed cheeks, tinted lips. Very little in the way of eyebrow, mascara or eye makeup as we'd see it today. So to our eyes, the look is often a little unfinished. But in portrait after portrait after portrait, what people are aspiring to is this idealisation of the English rose. And nobody embodies that more than the Queen herself.
That's interesting. Do you think the ideal was shaped by Elizabeth, or is she reflecting what was already popular?
I think both are happening. If you look at medieval iconography, the classic European medieval look is the same pale oval face, very delicately tinted, quite ethereal looking. In Elizabeth's case, she is such an interesting character when it comes to makeup, because all the evidence suggests that as a young princess, she prefers quite a simple look. She doesn't dress in excessive finery, even when she could. And she's very much about presenting herself as an educated young woman rather than as a fashion icon. But as she becomes more settled into her role as queen, I think she very deliberately takes on the iconography of the English rose that we see as symbolic of the Tudor court.
That's very interesting. Now, who is she turning to get these cosmetics, and how are the ingredients sourced?
Some of them have been around for a long time. If we look very briefly backwards to her father's court, we know that he quite deliberately encourages the extensive use of rose water as a way of giving physicality to that iconography. So as well as seeing the English rose, you would smell the rose as the court progresses and goes through. So by the time Elizabeth comes to the throne, cosmetics at court are absolutely nothing new. We know they've been around for a long time. And she would have been using the very best that was available to a woman of her rank. So she'll have been using things that are imported. There'd be a lot that have come in from places like Venice, which as a major trading hub is drawing on things like the spice trade and the trade with the Arabic world and then through the Orient through them. There are all sorts of very interesting ingredients that would be coming into Britain through wider trading networks. And some may have been made for her within the palace by her own apothecaries, but others may have been coming in as gifts, or they may be things that perhaps she's requested and have been sent away for.
Just to pick up on that point about Henry VIII and his court and rose water, do we see the use of cosmetics increasing over the 16th century? Would we have seen Catherine of Aragon or Anne Boleyn wearing cosmetics?
Quite possibly. There are references to Henry's court as being painted like peacocks. I forget the precise quote, but there are definite references to court women going to huge lengths to appear at their absolute best. Because your look is part of your status, and there is a very strong idea that outward beauty is a sign of inner goodness, so that your physical looks reflect your moral character. And if you want to be taken seriously in a very fast-paced court, you have to stand out on every count, and your looks will draw the attention, and then hopefully you can show people the other qualities that you have.
I've always known that about Henry, that he was praised because of his height and his appearance, and that was thought to represent his inner virtue. But I haven't thought before about the impact that would have on women, especially perhaps at the court, who are seeking to enhance their appearance precisely as a means of enhancing their virtue. I mean, I guess also that's why people were opposed to the artificiality, because it's the sense that actually you're deceiving the viewer into thinking that you're something you're not, if they make this direct correlation between outward and inward appearance.
You're absolutely right. And there are frequent commentaries throughout this century about the loathsomeness of cosmetics and the sin of using too many artificial means to enhance your beauty, and they always come down to moral virtue, that your virtue should be something people can see in you, and that if you mask that with cosmetics, then you're presenting an inaccurate face to the world.
Gosh, and we all do today, don't we? Do we know when Elizabeth began to wear makeup? I know that she contracted smallpox a few years into her reign. Is it associated with that, or do we know if it predates it?
I think that's highly likely. She is a little hard to trace. There are some aspects of her cosmetic use that we can see clearly in the records. So, for example, we know that everyone gives her presents at quite regular intervals. And when you look at the list of presents, there will quite often be things like looking glasses or scented waters or sweet bags in amongst those gifts. And they are nodding to her fondness for cosmetics. But an awful lot of the rest of it is kept fairly secret. They don't want to advertise the fact that she could possibly be aging and changing and being anything other than this absolutely solid, absolutely unchanging, eternally youthful, eternally beautiful figurehead of the English nation. And I think the smallpox thing is probably highly likely to be one of the deciding factors as to why she first starts wearing cosmetics. As a natural redhead, she'd have been a fairly pale-complexioned individual to start with, but skin like that, and I've got red hair myself, so skin like that, we flush, we get rashes, our skin's a little bit fragile. It's very easy for that youthful edge to be lost far earlier than somebody with a more robust complexion might get away. So I think when she gets smallpox, she's going to very quickly rely on cosmetic aids, both to soothe and heal the scars, but also to make sure that they're not visible to her public.
I'm struck by how difficult it must be to research this then, if there's a desire to cover up what's going on. And I was thinking about contemporary testimony and portraiture of Elizabeth. I know that base makeup was typically made from ceruse, though the amount that Elizabeth used has been widely debated, and, you know, whether it's a fine wash or a thick mask. And in part, that's because the evidence feels uncertain, and it tends to be people who are critical, you know, a Jesuit priest or a Puritan, who are saying she's wearing chunks on her cheeks. But of course they would, wouldn't they? So how much can we trust the contemporary evidence to be truthful as to how she actually looked?
I think it is something that we have to feel our way through fairly carefully. We know what is being recommended to society, women generally at the time. There are loads of recipes for face cosmetics. And the ceruse, the white lead, is one that comes through over and over and over again. And they talk about different qualities of lead that can be imported. There are versions that you can make at home. There are occasional commentaries on things you can use if you can't get the best qualities of lead. And if everybody at large is using these, the likelihood she's using one of the more rarefied versions at the absolute top of the scale. The tragedy of lead, we all know that it's poisonous. We've known it's been poisonous since the Roman period. There's actually a lovely Roman quote that says something along the lines of, "Why on earth are we making lead pipes for water when you've seen what the stuff does to women's faces?" So the Romans knew it was poisonous. They certainly know it's poisonous in the Tudor period. But the reason it's so popular is that, at least initially, you need very, very, very little of it The tiniest amount will blur the complexion. It's a metallic powder, so it sticks well without sweating off. As it's also a metallic pigment, it's light reflecting. So it's similar to some of these very advanced cosmetics we have today that will bounce the light back and make you look seamless in selfies. It's very much the same idea going on. So a very, very tiny amount absolutely works. I've used it experimentally, very carefully, but I have used it experimentally, and I can see why people loved it. It genuinely does make your skin look so much better. The trouble is you need more and more of it as time goes by.
And why is that?
Well, in the short term, it's drying. So in the very early stages of using it, if you have any skin eruptions, it's actually going to help them very briefly. It'll dry those up. It'll cover things very nicely. But as it starts to dry your skin, and the contemporary references are to skin withering, skin withers with the use of lead, you need to use a thicker and thicker layer to maintain the same results, by which time it's going to be having quite a few other effects on the system.
And what are they? I mean, how is the Queen's appearance and long-term health possibly at risk here?
So in the short term, it's going to have not just an impact on your skin, it's going to start getting into your bloodstream, and it will start doing things like affecting your gums. So your gums will start to recede and your teeth will blacken. Now, this is a problem for Elizabeth particularly because she has a famously sweet tooth, and we know that her dentition really suffers as she ages. Now, that could be largely to do with the sweets that she likes, but if she's using copious amounts of lead, that's certainly not going to be helping. So receding gums and a stinking breath will be one thing. It's going to impact your fertility. And there's a tragic irony here, because a lot of the women who are using lead are society women who are being married for dynastic purposes, and the ability to produce an heir is incredibly important. So if your fertility is being affected, you may not realise it, but this is eroding your status. And of course, one of Elizabeth's main reasons for appearing eternally youthful is it keeps her on the marriage market, even though we suspect she had absolutely no intention of marrying. The fact that she could be on the marriage market was important. Ultimately, though, lead is going to affect your mind. And there are reports that Elizabeth in her final years was a little bit irascible. She was grouchy. She would lose her temper at odd moments. She was a little bit unpredictable. Very hard to prove one way or another, but the lead won't be helping that. It's possible it's affecting her relationships with the wider court.
Hello, host of Dan Snow's History Hit podcast here. History isn't just dates and facts. It's about the incredible stories that shape our world. Three times a week on my podcast, my expert guests and I bring you extraordinary stories of heroism, discovery, mystery, and power. Expect tales of lost tombs, daring escapes, power-hungry rulers, and those determined to bring them all down. If you're a history lover or just looking for a good tale, you'll want to check out Dan Snow's History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
The black teeth, can I just pop back to those? Because we do have reports about her blackened teeth. And I've always wondered, was that considered a kind of status symbol, an indicator of her wealth that she can eat that much sugar? Or did they look at them and think they were revolting?
I think both is true. We certainly have a lot of cosmetic recipes which are about improving the teeth. Now, some of them work quite well. We've got a fair few that are very simple mixtures of things like salt or chalk or soot and some herbal ingredients, which would act as a fairly abrasive but perfectly usable tooth polish. We've got quite a few mouthwash recipes which use ingredients that are absolutely fine. Things like tincture of myrrh mixed in with something like a mint or rosemary tea. I ran that past my dentist not too long ago and he said, that's absolutely fine. I wouldn't have any huge problem with somebody telling me that they were using something similar. But we've also got other things which just reflect the attitudes to medicine at the time. So there's a widespread belief that where you have sweet flavours, you have sweetness of character. So if you were to scrub your mouth with sugar or honey, the belief is this will give you sweet breath. So Elizabeth's sweet tooth is probably being encouraged. And if you suck a sweet, this will sweeten your breath. And of course, we know today that it's doing the exact opposite.
Now, lead isn't the only one of the substances that she's using that is toxic, is it?
There's quite a few things. So there are any number of recipes that use things like arsenic, almost in a sort of skin peel. These are put on as a face mask. And the idea is that they will etch away the top layer of old skin and reveal a fresh skin underneath. The likelihood is all it does is make your skin terribly irritated. And that's really not going to be good in the long run. But you've also got things in the colour cosmetics. So we know that a pink tinge to the cheeks is very popular. And you could use something safe like red ochre, which is available to all classes. You could use imported things, red sandalwood, Brazil wood, even cochineal coming over from the fairly newly opened up Americas. But you're also likely to be using something like vermilion, which is made from cinnabar, which is red mercuric sulfide. It's mercury. That's going to be also really, really bad for you.
And that would have been used on the cheeks and possibly the lips as well?
And possibly the lips. And as soon as you put anything on your lips, of course, you're going to be licking it off. It's going to be getting into your system. And all of these ingredients have really slow but deadly effects on the system. They'll almost all of them just decline your health generally. They'll eat away at your ability for your system to renew itself. And if she is using the very highest grades of cosmetics available, the likelihood is that there are several things on her dressing table that aren't helping. It is one of the real tragic ironies that the very richest are ending up with the cosmetics that are doing the very worst for them, whereas somebody just one rung down the social scale may be using fractionally cheaper equivalents that are actually preserving their looks far better.
Now, you've been very brave and put some of these things on your skin, but I also know that some substances have been tested in recent years in lab conditions to understand how they appeared in the past. What can we learn through such processes of recreation?
There's always things that we can learn from these. From my perspective as an experimental archaeologist, I'm interested in both the process and the end result. So the work that I do tends to look at how we make these things. What do the raw materials look like? How do you combine them? What sort of shelf life has it got? As well as what it looks like on the skin. Whereas in vitro testing, we'll very much look at the actual physical effects on the human system. And there are academics out there who specialise in things like toxicology in cosmetics and can go into endless detail about not only what happens historically, but where these things are still found today. Because even though they're all technically banned, it's amazing how often impure elements do turn up in cosmetic recipes.
I mean, it's certainly true that most of us have no idea what we're putting on our faces when we put on cosmetics today. And we trust the system. We trust that they've been tested and that they're hopefully, if you're vegetarian or vegan, not tested on animals or whatever. But we don't really know, do we?
No, you're right. We trust the system. And we're fairly lucky that in the UK and the EU, there are very stringent cosmetic regulations. So even if I myself were to try and put an historic recipe back on the market, I have to go through exactly the same hoops that any of the large cosmetic chains that you might find on the high street have to. The recipe has to be signed off by a cosmetic chemist. It has to be logged with various government bodies. You have to make the recipes and the contents available for scrutiny if any medical practitioner wanted to. That's not true worldwide. There are plenty of places in the world where anybody can cook up a cosmetic in their kitchen, put it for sale, that's entirely legal, and you just have to trust that it's of a good quality.
Okay, so back to the 16th century. I've seen the term varnish used when talking about the use of egg wash on the skin. Was this used before or after the lead? And what was it for?
As far as we can tell, this is a way of setting the skin, priming it, so that the cosmetics you put on afterwards will create a thin mask that will stay absolutely put for the entire of an evening. There's two possible ways they're doing this. Some of the records suggest that it is as simple as you beat an egg, you dip a brush in it, you paint this onto your face, much as we might a cosmetic primer today, and then you adopt a pleasant expression and wait for your face to set. I have tried this. It's awful. It's the most terrible feeling in the world, because as the egg dries, it draws in and your face feels like it's shrinking. And then if you grin too much, and a lot of these things are quite funny, so you do end up laughing while you're trying them, your face cracks. You end up with this sort of slightly crazed effect. So the idea is that you would varnish your face and then you would apply your cosmetics over the top, which would go onto this incredibly smooth surface and would hopefully make you look glowing and completely impervious to everything for the rest of the evening. The other possibility is that they're drawing more on the idea of sympathetic magic. Now, what's happening here is that there is a huge interest in alchemy during this period. This is the early chemistry of the period. And today we think of alchemy as being very much about slightly occult approaches. But alchemy in the Tudor period is about understanding the world and understanding how one element can be turned into another. So not just lead into gold, it's about getting virtue out of ingredients. And there are many cosmetic washes which rely on taking certain ingredients and distilling them so that the virtue comes over in the distillate. So if you distill eggs, you're not going to end up with anything terribly exciting. You're going to end up with a bland liquid at the end of it. So it's mostly just the water in the eggs that's distilling over. But the idea is that the virtue of this embryonic object, this egg that has the potential to be something new and young and vibrant, is going to come across into the water. In that case, you're just washing your face with a slightly odd scented water. Some of these washes are quite strange, though. We have recipes for puppy dog water, for example.
I hesitate to ask, what is puppy dog water?
Unfortunately, it's exactly what you think it is. You take a beautiful, young, soft, perfect puppy. Sadly, it doesn't survive the experience. You distill it, and the water is supposed to contain all the virtues of all the things that make the puppy young and beautiful and adorable. And this isn't a one-off. We have lots of references to this. In the next century or so, Samuel Pepys, very famous diarist, is extremely cross with his wife because she tries puppy dog water and he's utterly outraged by the idea of it.
So to be explicit, this isn't urine. This is something made from the innards or the body, the blood of a puppy dog.
Yes, sadly, you chop up a puppy and you distill it. You'll put it into an alembic, a large retort with other liquids, some of which may or may not do something, that they're probably just wine or water. You distill it and the resulting water is used as a cosmetic toner.
Gosh, this is horrifying. I mean, you mentioned cochineal. Is this use of animal-derived products quite common?
It is. In the case of the cochineal, there is some debate as to how many people knew that cochineal were insects. If you look at Tudor dyeing recipes, so for dyeing cloth, cochineal and kermes, a related species that you find on the continent, is often referred to as grain because it does look like little tiny pellets when you bring it in. You wouldn't immediately know that each cochineal grain is the dried body of an insect. And we're not certain how many people would have realised that it was of animal origin to start with. Their sensibilities are nowhere near as delicate as ours are today. People are perfectly capable of adoring their pets. They're perfectly capable of deciding that something is extremely sweet and cute and all the rest of it. But they are quite ruthless when it comes down to making use of ingredients.
And perfume. Tell me about perfume.
Oh, there are so many at the time. So we know that rose water has been incredibly popular for several centuries at this point, highly used in Henry's court, certainly very widely used in Elizabeth's. But we're also starting to get a real trend towards animal-based perfumes. So things like musk and civet and ambergris, all of which are strong smelling and very lasting. And probably it's the lasting quality, first and foremost, that makes them popular.
So perhaps you ought to explain where those scents come from. It might not be immediately obvious to people where they're from.
Of course. So they're things that until very recently we've found even in high-end perfumes today. These days we tend not to. But musk comes from the gland on the stomach of the musk deer. And sadly, you do have to kill the deer to get it. And it's used to make perfumes last. It is still an incredibly important perfume today, but we largely use a nature-identical synthetic. Civet comes from a gland near the anus of the civet cat, which is actually a type of weasel. It's not a cat at all. And it has an incredibly powerful, very animally, slightly toilety smell, which in quantities smells revolting, but in extreme dilution, particularly with flower perfumes, it adds warmth and adds richness and it adds staying power. And although very few people today would enjoy the scent of it raw, many of us are familiar with its effect because, again, these days nature-identical synthetics, but very similar elements have been used in some of the classic perfumes of the 20th and 21st century. Ambergris, though, that one comes from whales. So it's actually regurgitated from the stomach of a whale. So in a sense, it's whale vomit, although it's a little bit more complicated than that. And the best quality has floated around on the ocean for a considerable amount of time. You still occasionally get references to people beachcombing and finding lumps of it in some parts of the world and absolutely making their fortune because ethically sourced, so wave wash that the whale has just happened to parted company with by itself, ethically sourced ambergris is still incredibly valuable in trade.
By definition, though, you're saying that quite a lot of the time it was not ethically sourced.
Yeah, I think in the days when whaling was very widely practiced, chunks of ambergris were removed. It's not going to be as good a quality. It's that aging process out on the waves that turns it into something really high quality. But we know that the whale products, whale oil and other products, are becoming very widespread from the Tudor period onwards.
Just a few more questions for you then, Sally. You mentioned Elizabeth was a redhead, famously. And one thing I'm struck by when I look at the pictures or descriptions of the 16th century is quite how many people appeared to be redheads. Was it more common then, do we know? You might not know this, but it seems surprising how many portraits show people with red hair.
I doubt that we've changed genetically in the time between now and then. If anything, we've become more diverse as a population and we're more likely to have the gene mixes that allow for things like redhead showing up. I think there's good evidence that people are tinting their hair in emulation of the absolute head of society. The queen is the head of society. So if your hair can even remotely lend itself in that direction, a little bit of lightening, a little bit of highlighting, well, why wouldn't you?
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought of that. How much do you think has changed in terms of women's appearances, in terms of how they're discussed, particularly women in positions of power?
To some extent, I think very little has changed. We would all like to feel that any woman in any role of life is valued for herself, for what she brings academically or practically or for physical prowess, whatever sphere of life she's in. But you only have to look at social media and the pressure that young women are reporting to conform to often incredibly impossible ideals. In these days of AI manipulated images, we're getting more and more young women almost being brainwashed into thinking that your look should reflect something that is just physically impossible. So sadly, I think some things haven't changed, even though we would all defend any young woman who said, no, I don't wish to wear makeup. I wish to have my hair as nature intended. I'm going to dress incredibly practically. I'm going to go into an incredibly academic or physical profession. But we still come back to this idea of telling young women that they look beautiful or that their hairdo suits them or that the couple of pounds they've lost have made them look so much the better. I don't think a huge amount has changed.
Well, on that sobering note, we shall finish. Thank you so much, Sally, for a really fascinating tour through Elizabethan cosmetics and what that means when we think about it in terms of the implications for society and for people's health and indeed the long-lasting impact. Thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, and also to my researcher, Alice Smith, my producer, Rob Weinberg, and Ella Blacksall, who edited this episode. We're always eager to hear from you, so do drop us a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on X, formerly known as Twitter, @NotJustTudors. And do remember to follow Not Just the Tudors wherever you get your podcasts, so you get each new episode as soon as it's released.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age, a house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.